Marx's dictum about being determines consciousness is not only about why people have bad ideas from the past, it's also a method for the future about not just taking power momentarily in a romantic, beautiful, symbolic way as they did in Paris, but in order to transform the world for future generations. And so I think that that is really the fundamental lesson that we have to learn from the Bolshevik Revolution.
That's Todd Kreshen. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Todd Kreshen on Red October, the Russian Revolution. The upheaval and regime change in Russia in 1917 shook the world, in the words of journalist John Reed. In place of the feudal czarist monarchy came radical revolutionaries. A civil war ensued, pitting former regime elements against the communists. In addition, a number of countries, including the United States, Britain, and France, didn't like what they saw and heard from Lenin, Trotsky, and the other Bolshevik leaders. They invaded Russia in an attempt to destroy the revolution and bring back the old order. Churchill said the Russian Revolution must be strangled in its cradle. They didn't succeed. A few years after Lenin's death in 1924, Stalin takes over the country. His rivals are sent into exile, jailed, or killed. The dictatorship calcifies. In 1991, the Soviet Union ends. The centenary of the Russian Revolution has sparked renewed interest in its history. Our guest today is Todd Kreshen. He's a member of the International Socialist Organization and is a frequent contributor to Socialist Worker and the International Socialist Review. He's the editor of Eyewitnesses to the Russian Revolution. He spoke at the International Socialist Organization's annual conference in Chicago. And now, Todd Kreshen.
Why do we talk about the Russian Revolution 100 years later? For much of the previous century, for let's say half or two-thirds of it, the Russian Revolution had a material direct impact both on states, capitalist states hostile to it, and on generations of workers in their millions who understood the Russian Revolution as a critical touchstone in history, as a defining political event that if you understood someone's attitude towards the Russian Revolution, you understood a lot about their worldview, about the question of trade unions, about the liberation of the oppressed, about the capitalist state, about war and peace. The Russian Revolution for generations was a defining political event for millions of people. I would argue that today, because of Stalinism, because of McCarthyism, because of the long period of time which has elapsed since the revolution, we are no longer in a period where there is an automatic social, cultural understanding of what the Russian Revolution presents. We have a lot of talk in the press, but it's probably uncommon, or actually we don't have that much talk in the press. We have a little bit of talk in the press. Bhaskar Sankara published a very interesting piece in the New York Times referring to the Bolshevik Revolution. Tariq Ali also was in the New York Times on the question of Lenin and the revolution. So there is some talk in this 100th anniversary, but it is not a question of your cousins, your uncles, your aunts, your brothers, your sisters understand and have been told the story from their friends and their parents of the meaning of the Russian Revolution. That cultural history inside the working class, at least in the United States and in many places in the world, has been obliterated by Stalinism, by time, and by repression. So when we talk about the Russian Revolution, one of our tasks is understanding, is it simply a historical anomaly that is interesting, and there are many interesting things. Studying history, I would argue, is intrinsically wonderful, and everyone should pursue it. But is there something more to it? Why should we study the Russian Revolution? Why should young radicals today who care about Black Lives Matter, who care about the environment, who care about equal pay for women, who care about abortion rights, who care about transgender rights, why should people caring about trade unions and $15 an hour care about these strange people called the Bolsheviki and the Russian Revolution that happened 100 years ago? And I would argue the following, and then we'll get into the history of what actually happened. Our responsibility as revolutionaries today is to learn the history of the revolution extract its key lessons from that history and make them available today for a new generation of people for the following reason. There have been many revolutions since. There have been heroic mass struggles against oppression. There have been tremendous strike waves all around the world. But the Russian Revolution is the one time in the working class's history where we were able to pass over from resistance to everything that they do to us over to power, over to being able to remake the world in the way that we want to remake it. That is an experience that is singular to the Russian Revolution in its depth and complexity and meaning. And that is why we have to carry those lessons forward. There's no other terrain in which you can learn the uses of proletarian power, the impact of workers transforming themselves from an oppressed class into a class in power and beginning to remake the world. This is a whole bunch of strategy and tactics that most workers have never had a chance to play out in a historical situation because the struggle was always circumvented, was always cut short before they got to their October. So with that proviso, I would say that we have a responsibility as revolutionaries not to assume that other people will care, but to understand that our task is to study the revolution, learn its lessons, and bring those lessons to the fore for a new generation of people. I don't think, my guess is that the Russian Revolution will not be the main cultural marker for mass struggle in the United States. People will not make a socialist revolution in the United States in the main with the banner of Lenin. They will make it with the banner of Malcolm X, with Martin Luther King, with our cultural heroes in this country. However, the cadre of that revolution cannot be a cadre that can win a revolution without understanding the lessons of Lenin and the Bolsheviki and their friends. So it is not a question of everyone in the world has to know this or there's something wrong with them, but if you want to be a revolutionary and an effective socialist revolutionary today, you are hamstrung until you understand the meaning of the Russian Revolution. So that's my proviso. Now what happens? This is what the first lesson of the Russian Revolution. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go through sort of the months. I'm not going to attempt to do a narrative. Thankfully, China Mayville has just written this wonderful new book called October, which I think is the heir of Trotsky's history of the Russian Revolution. If you want in 300 pages to understand or begin to understand the Russian Revolution, read China's book. It is a masterpiece, in my opinion. So I'm not going to try to read it page for page, as much as that is tempting. What I want to do is go through a little bit of the narrative so you have some points to understand the pace of events, but also try to draw some lessons out of each phase. So why do we care about the Russian Revolution? And how does it? What is its impact at the time? This is what Victor Serge said about the meaning of the Russian Revolution back in 1918. Victor Serge was an anarchist who went over to the Bolsheviks and became an important writer and figure that people may have heard before. So this is what Victor Serge says. He says, riots in Paris, riots in Lyon, revolution in Belgium, revolution in Constantinople, victory of the Soviets in Bulgaria, rioting in Copenhagen. In fact, the whole of Europe is in movement. Clandestine or open Soviets are appearing everywhere, even in the Allied armies. Everything is possible, everything. This is Victor Serge's assessment of the impact of the Russian Revolution into the war-ravaged countries of Europe. And I won't go through the quotes, but the leaders of European capitalism essentially agreed on the danger from the opposite point of view. What then do those mass upsurges mean? And what I want to do is attempt to sustain an argument throughout the course of this talk about power. That we, as I said before, are very accustomed to resisting. How many people here have been on protest in the last couple of, basically everybody, right? And if you weren't, I'm sure you wanted to be, right? So our movement and our tradition, we look to resistance. We look to people fighting the power, but we have almost no examples of ever becoming the power. And often we get torn in small circles of believing that the chairperson has power, I'm going to resist the chairperson, mistaking what is real social and economic power for small fights amongst the left, small fights amongst each other. One of the things about the Russian Revolution is to identify the sources of real political and economic power in society, and as Marx argued, that starts with capitalism, the owners of the means of production, and the job of socialism is to overcome that power and to replace it with a new sort of power. I'll just paraphrase Marx says in the German ideology. He says the production of mass consciousness for communism must take place in a practical movement, in a revolution. And therefore, a revolution is necessary for two principal reasons. One is that the old ruling class cannot be overcome in any other way than a revolution. That is, they're simply too powerful with the means of their disposal to relent and allow social justice without a revolution. And that's important, and I think people instinctively understand that. You look at our government, and it is a brutal and brutalizing institution, and it's difficult to imagine the powers that be in this country simply giving up power. The banks handing over their money, the Pentagon withdrawing its 155 bases around the world, etc. The prison system voluntarily shutting down. We understand that they have power, and some mass upheaval must take place in order to challenge their power. The second part of Marx's emphasis, though, I think is even more meaningful and more important for socialists. And what he says is, not only do we have to overthrow the old ruling class, but in so doing, in the process of a revolution, the oppressed class, the working class, must become fit to found a new society. That is, only in the process of revolution can working class people overcome, as Marx says, all the old crap which has been drilled into them for their whole lives. So this process of revolution is necessary to not only defeat the forces that be, but in order to create the unity and the power and the ability within the working class to rule in our own name. So that's really why the Russian Revolution is critical. So why is it possible in Russia? Why does it break through in Russia? I'm not going to go through all of the ins and outs again, but here in a nutshell is the situation in Russia. And understanding this from the point of view of both objective circumstances, this is a big thing you're going to hear Marxists say all the time, objective circumstances and subjective circumstances. In February, the war had been raging for 3 years, several million Russian soldiers dead or missing, several million civilians injured or displaced, starving to death. The country is being torn apart. The conditions for the capitalist class in Russia were intensifyingly bad and going from bad to worse. Obviously, the conditions for workers and peasants in Russia were even more dire. So you have, on the one hand, a system of capitalism that is in the deepest crisis that any major capitalist state has ever faced in the Russian Empire. On the other hand, you have the subjective. You have a working class which is small but extremely combative, condensed into big factories in the major cities, that has a tradition of having lost a revolution in 1905, and not simply lost a revolution in which there were a few protests, a few attempts to go on strike, but a revolution in 1905 that came close to pushing the Tsar out of power. And the price the workers paid in 1905 for almost winning was 15,000 executions, 30,000 people into exile, and a mass repression across the country. So the working class learned in 1905 that if we are going to rise up, we better have a plan to win. If you push the Tsar halfway, he will come back with wrath and fury and execute your family. That's the lesson that people learn in 1905. And it creates a tremendously radical, politicized working class. So it is not the question of a small, isolated intellectual socialist movement over here and a passive trade union movement over here. Rather, it is a working class that has been both brutalized but has already had a sense of its own power. And I'll go through the parties in a minute that represented it. But those are the two forces that begin to clash in February. And long story short, the old Tsar, his armies collapsing, his military in revolt, the workers on strike, the peasants rebelling, he finally decides to call it quits. And the workers overthrow the Tsar, they get rid of the old monarchy, and now the question is what sort of government will replace the Tsar. And this brings us, so that's the February Revolution in very short order. In March, the beginning of March, because it's sort of February and March, there arises two competing institutions which are potential sources of political power in Russia. And this is what we refer to as dual power. How many people here have heard of dual power? So like half the people. Okay, so a little explanation. Dual power is a scenario that arises fairly commonly in mass upheavals, where a old bad government gets pushed out of the way, and usually there's some sort of ad hoc institution which claims to be a better form of the old government that steps in and declares that it will take care of things. And we've seen this happen many times in history. In the case of Russia, a group stepped forward calling themselves the Provisional Government. And this was more or less an ad hoc group of people who are well-known politicians representing a spectrum of opinion from fairly conservative aristocrats all the way over to moderate socialists, the Provisional Government. There wasn't an election for this Provisional Government. There was a thin reliance on a series of old undemocratic elections that the Tsar had permitted to found this new government. But in essence, it was an ad hoc government of politicians trying to say, we speak in the name of the people, and eventually there'll be some elections to codify our power. But for the moment, we speak in the name of the revolution. So that's the Provisional Government on one hand. On the other hand, the other side of dual power is an institution that rises up called the Soviet. And the Soviet is just a Russian word which means council. But we still insist on saying Soviet instead of council. Accident of history. So the Workers' Council, the Soviet, began to represent through direct elections the peasants, the sailors, and the soldiers, and the workers. So what you would do is we would have a factory, and we'd say there's a couple hundred people here. We all get a delegate. So who would like to vote? Who would like to be the delegate? There's a Bolshevik, there's a Menshevik, there's an SR, there's a Menshevik Internationalist, there's somebody else, there's an anarchist, there's a more conservative worker. We debate, we decide, we vote. That delegate goes and represents our factory at the Soviet, at the Workers' Council, until we decide that we want to replace them, and we can replace them at any time. So that institution, the Soviet, this very direct democratic organization of the masses, begins to compete with the Provisional Government. And in some sense, the story of the rest of the revolution is the competition between these two institutions. Will we go back to a provisional government which relies on the capitalist class and a relationship with the capitalist class, or will we go forward to a new form of democracy, direct democracy, based on the Soviet, based on the working class? This dual power is very unstable, and it's very new. So one of the things about the dual power is that it's surprising. The provisional government, although it still represents the old order in some way, doesn't do so in a crude, conservative manner. So this is what Claude Anet says. Claude Anet, who was a French officer who was in Russia at the time. This is what he says about the provisional government. He says in March, "The government was granting everything which was asked of it. We want a free Poland, free, united, intact, say the Poles. You shall have a free Poland, united and intact," answers the provisional government. "The women say, we want the right to vote. You shall have the right to vote. The different races are agitating. Equality of all races, of all religions. Everyone's right of admission to all offices, abolition of all restrictions." And the government said, "We are decided on equality. In the dawn of liberty, the government refuses nothing. All desires are crowned. All prayers received a favorable hearing. Ask for the moon, it will be given to you by decree. But I am inclined to think that the government knows very well what it is doing. It understands the Russian mind, which requires fine promises. And in reality, what does it give? Lavish promises. And meanwhile, time passes. We shall thus pass from material impossibility to material impossibility, to postponing the elections until after the war. That is the only reasonable solution." And Claude Anet is he's a sort of sympathetic to the moderate socialist, totally hostile to the Soviet and to the Bolsheviks, but he does a wonderful description of the government's maneuver. In the face of a mass revolt, the liberals promise and retreat, and they bide their time. That's the program of the provisional government. So that counterpost to that is the Soviet. This is the Soviet's conditions for supporting the provisional government, at least partially. And this is the first order that the Petrograd Soviet gives out. Think about this. Election of soldiers' committees in every military unit, election of their representatives to the Soviet. Subordination of soldiers in the Soviet in political institutions. Subordination of soldiers to the military commission, that is a joint commission, insofar as, again and crucially, as its orders do not deviate from the Soviets. Control of weapons by soldiers' committee. Military discipline while on duty with full civil rights at other times. Abolition of offices, officers, honorary titles. So this is a if the provisional government is promising change in the future, the Soviet at this point, the coalition of socialist parties representing the working class, is granting to the soldiers essentially veto rights over the high command and the democratic election of delegates within the military to then veto military policy and officers' authority. But they're saying, you're in power, we'll share it. All we want is the right to veto everything that the military says during a war. And you think, oh, that's a nice deal, right? I guess we can all get along, we can all agree on that. So if the provisional government is promising change in the future, the Soviet government is threatening change in the future. And these two forces exist in an unstable alliance. Now, that's the picture in March. In April, Lenin comes back from exile, as most of the socialist leadership was exiled during the period between 1905 and 1917. Lenin and a bunch of people come back through a series of very strange maneuvers. They get through Germany on a SEAL train. Both Lenin and Martov, by the way, the leaders of the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks, all do the same thing, so we'll leave that aside. But they get back into Russia, and there is now this question posed within the Bolshevik Party about how do we understand this tension between the provisional government and the Soviet government. And Lenin lays out this very ingenious description of the different parties' positions that are involved in this whole process. There's a group called the Cadets, which are essentially, I'll call them the Democratic Party. They are the liberal aristocrats and middle class and capitalists. And they, of course, wanted to work with the Tsar. They wanted a constitutional monarchy. When the Tsar abdicated, they were left without a monarchy, so they were trying to keep things as little change as possible, although they wanted universal suffrage for men. And that's a big change from an autocracy, so they did want some change, but they were basically trying to keep things in check. So this is the Cadets. There's a group called the Socialist Revolutionary Party, and they are a party both based on support of the peasantry, but also radical intelligentsia. And they are for redistribution of the land, and they have some very radical demands, but are also sort of caught between whether or not we should overthrow capitalism or we should try to negotiate with capitalism. There's the Menshevik Party. Very quickly, I'm just going to do shorthand, which is Menshevik means moderate socialist, Bolshevik means revolutionary socialist. But the moderate socialists get pulled in two different directions because they really do want socialism, but there's a debate about can we overthrow capitalism now? Can we end the war now? Can we redistribute the land now? Or do we have to find a way to come to an accommodation with the capitalist class and only get those reforms that we can work out without creating an intense crisis that will rip the country apart? They are stuck between this position of we want socialism, but in order to get socialism, we have to wait for a whole historical period for the country to develop. In the meantime, we need to have some sort of semi-unity with at least some of the capitalist class. And that is a very difficult contradiction. And in fact, the party gets pulled in two different directions. Lenin comes back in April of 1917, and the Bolshevik Party, in my opinion, has an attitude towards the provisional government, which is that they do not trust them. The provisional government makes its promises, and we do not trust those promises in the main. That the bulk of the Bolshevik Party believes that workers have to continue to fight, that they should not rely on the capitalists for anything, that they should not trust the other more moderate parties, that they have to immediately end the war, they have to take any actions necessary to end the war, redistribute the land, the workers should take over the factories. An extremely radical revolutionary program. But they are stuck in a bit of a position about what do we do about the provisional government? Because it's promising all this stuff, and most people still support the provisional government, and we are a small minority at this point. We have 25,000 members. That's a very good number of members to have, but if you have 3 to 10 million workers, depending on how you count it, you're still a small minority. So if you want the working class to take power, but you are a small minority, and the workers don't yet want to take power, what do you do? In the meantime, do we attempt to come to some sort of accommodation with the provisional government, or should we push now for workers' power? Should we try to overthrow the provisional government? And a debate is raging within the Bolshevik Party about all these strategies and tactics. Lenin comes back with a very definite attitude, and he presents a thing called the April Theses and a series of other discussions, and his point is quite simple, which is that we have wanted a bourgeois revolution in Russia. We've wanted to overthrow the Tsar. The Tsar is overthrown. Now we're moving on to the second phase of the revolution. And in that second phase of the revolution, the contest will be between the provisional government or the Soviets. It can't be both. We should fight for Soviet power. And our slogan should become, although he doesn't use the words, they come a little bit later, all power to the Soviets. And in the meantime, because we're still a small minority, our job will be to explain to the working class why the only way to solve the questions of the war and capitalism and all the problems that go with it is that they have to take power through the Soviets, that they have to overthrow the provisional government and replace a reliance on the capitalist class or a coalition with the capitalist class with workers' power. And this thesis provokes a lot of debate in the Bolshevik Party. Some would say that Lenin came back with these ideas and almost nobody else had them. I think he certainly had a much more specific and definite attitude towards the question of the state because of State and Revolution, a book he was writing. But he was not alone in the Bolshevik Party in believing that the provisional government was the enemy and that the working class had to take power in alliance with the poor peasantry. But he helped galvanize that section of the party that was already debating and thinking through these ideas and win over the vast majority of the party in short order. Not only did he do so through the power of argument, but also events were moving very quickly. So if in late February and early March you could believe that the provisional government was promising to end the war, what happens in late April and May proves that the provisional government's promises should not be taken at face value. So there's a Milyukov, who's a minister in the provisional government, essentially promises France and Britain, they're about to be, that the Allies, that Russia will honor its commitments and continue the war till victory. This becomes public, mass demonstrations are provoked, he's forced to resign from the government, and the working class understands that if the provisional government is making promises, at least some people in the provisional government are lying to your face. Maybe not everybody, but at least some of them. And so there's a lessons that are taking place very rapidly. So it's not just Lenin has a good argument, he convinces everybody. It's also that events are moving very quickly, and the logic of the government that is still in power, the provisional government, should not be trusted, is taking hold. So that's April. In May, as if to put a finer point on it, there's a socialist, a guy from the Socialist Revolutionary Party, or a faction of it called the Trudoviki, named Kerensky. And Kerensky becomes, he's sort of a strange figure. He's very dynamic, but also a bit histrionic, a little bit full of himself. You might have met people like this before. And that he comes to believe that he is the embodiment of the Russian Revolution. And at first is quite popular. He's quite a good orator. He has a record of being a lawyer defending workers who had been oppressed by the Tsar before. So he's not a nobody. He comes in to a historical situation and he says, I represent the Russian Revolution. I will speak in the name of Russian democracy. And he's both in the Soviet and in the provisional government. And he tries to walk this line. But here's why it gets very difficult to walk that line. As the war intensifies and the debate becomes war or peace, provisional government or Soviet, Kerensky is trying to hold these two things together. And this is what Kerensky does. He goes to the front and he says, we have to agitate amongst the soldiers, not to end the war, but to start a new offensive against Germany. And this is what Kerensky says. This is Kerensky's autobiography. Forward to the battle for freedom. I summon you not to a feast, but to death. These are the words that I used before the conference at Kamenets-Podolsk. These words were also the keynotes of my addresses all along the front line positions. This is what Lenin says. We call you to social revolution. We summon you not to die for others, but to destroy others, to destroy your class enemies in the rear. Then Kerensky says, this counter-slogan of Lenin carried with it a terrible force, for it justified beforehand the animal fear of death, which lurks in the heart of even the bravest. And you can hear Kerensky. It supplied in the mind of the arguments the support of everything that was dark, cowardly, and selfish in the army. There is nothing remarkable about this, but et cetera. And then he and the provisional government, a month later, launch an offensive to try to defeat Germany. Basically, France is saying, if you want the money to keep coming, you have to fight. So Kerensky launches an offensive in June. It goes well for a few days, and then it's a disaster. And hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers are maimed, killed, or taken prisoner. A total disaster. So this, again, is a lesson. It's the Bolsheviks saying, all power to the Soviet. Workers can't trust the government. They have to take power in their own name. But it's also events that the provisional government, in the name of the provisional government, as Kerensky says, forward to battle for freedom. I summon you not to a feast, but to death. That is Kerensky's program, and people are saying, okay. There is a couple anecdotes I want to get to real quick in June, because I think to the question of power, the soldiers and the workers are instinctively becoming more and more oppositional, more and more radical. The Bolsheviks are becoming more popular. But at the same time, there's a difficulty, as we were saying at the beginning, of going from being people who resist to being people who take power. There is a difference between saying no to your boss and saying, we are removing the boss and we shall now run society. That is a psychological barrier that, as an oppressed class of whatever race, of whatever gender, as an oppressed class, working class people are taught that you follow orders, you do what you're told. Sometimes if it's unjust, you may say that's unjust and I demand a different order. But at the end of the day, you are not the people setting the terms of exploitation and of political power. You are trying to negotiate with a hostile power to you. So going from resistance to power is a very difficult psychological leap.
You're listening to Todd Kreshin on Red October, the Russian Revolution. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
In June, there's a guy named Fyodor Raskolnikov, who is a young sailor who's a Bolshevik. And the guy's quite a character. You should really read about him. He and the Bolsheviks decide from Kronstadt that they're going to go on a tour of all of the ships that are embarked outside of Petrograd. So imagine this. This is the Navy. The Bolsheviks say, we're going to send around, it's actually through the Kronstadt Soviet, which was mostly controlled by the Bolsheviks, we're going to send our delegates to all the ships, call the sailors together, have meetings, talk about how we should end the war and overthrow the provisional government. Let's get in a rowboat, row out there, knock on the ship, climb up the gangplank, and here you are on the ship, and you say to the commander, we in the name of the Soviet demand a meeting on deck with all the sailors, and we want the officers below deck so that they can't hear what we're saying. Now, that's hard to imagine that happening today, right? But you still respect the authority of the officers. The officers still formally control the ship, even if the sailors have the right to have a meeting. And Raskolnikov, I think, has a wonderful anecdote to explain this. So they have the meeting. They say, oh, the Bolsheviks are pretty cool. We like them. And he says, as we are saying our goodbye to the sailor comrades and to the officers who stood nearby, I came upon one young officer who refused to give me his hand. I said, why didn't you give me your hand? He said, so the officer said, on account of your political views. And Raskolnikov says, the Bolshevik, but pardon me, I am a representative of a certain political party, and I honestly and sincerely express the views which I profess. Tell me why I should deserve to be treated with such contempt that you refuse to shake hands with me. And the officer says, I didn't intend to insult you. And he says, I acted as my feelings prompted me. And then Raskolnikov says, but if your feelings had prompted you to hit me in the face, then regardless of your intentions, that would have been an insult. And then the officer says, if you consider yourself insulted, I apologize. He was confused. And I asked him to be more careful next time. And then Raskolnikov reports him to the ship's sailors committee and says, you should take action against this officer. That is right up to power. But it's still not power. It is saying to the authority, you must respect our growing authority. But it still acknowledges a different authority. I think it's a wonderful anecdote. This explodes in July, into the July days, which I talked about a little bit at the beginning, because Kerensky's offensive collapses and it's such a disaster. The soldiers and the sailors revolt, the workers in Petrograd revolt, and the Bolsheviks are now stuck in the situation of being at the head of a mass revolt in the biggest city or cities, mostly in St. Petersburg, in which it's clear that the provisional government, with Kerensky at the head, I represent the Russian Revolution, I summon you to death, and then people follow and they die, and people now say, who you are, lied to us, you represent the continuity with the old regime, we want a revolution, the Bolsheviks have been talking about a revolution, the Bolsheviks have been talking about all power to the Soviet, now is the time. With guns in hand, tens of thousands of soldiers and sailors and workers into the streets demanding an overthrow of the provisional government, but only in St. Petersburg. And this then presents a very difficult question of power. Can you simply take power in a locality, Can the workers in a very radical spot, Paris Commune was one, can the workers in a very radical spot overthrow capitalism on their own? Or do you need a relationship, do you need support in the entire country across a vast empire? And the Bolsheviks make a very difficult decision, or at least it's a messy situation, but the majority of the Bolshevik leadership finds a way to say, we are with you, we understand why you are trying to follow what we've been telling you, overthrow the provisional government, all power of the Soviets, but we cannot take power now only in St. Petersburg. We have to wait. And this is very unpopular, because waiting means that Kerensky is going to send you back to the front and you are going to die. That's the soldier's point of view. So saying wait is a very difficult position for revolutionaries to be in, but the Bolsheviks use their political authority to give the uprising cover, to take responsibility for it, and then they become the people who the government goes after. Alexandra Kollontai, Trotsky, Kamenev, Zinoviev, orders for the arrest of Lenin, he goes underground, etc. But this is a pitched battle in one city, which is almost a revolution. At one point, Chernov, who is the socialist revolutionary, who is now in charge of agriculture in the city, comes out to try to calm down the soldiers. And the soldiers say, are you a Bolshevik? And he says, no, I represent the Socialist Revolutionary Party. And they say, are you willing to arrest Kerensky and overthrow the provisional government? And he says, no, we need unity with the provisional government. We have a coalition. And they say, you know, you are for continuing the war. Why can't we end the war? And he tries to give a speech. And one guy jumps up and shakes his fist and says, take power, you son of a bitch, when it's given to you. Which is right, it's a continuation of Raskolnikov. It is right up to it. It is, you should take power on our behalf. You're even better than Kerensky. Why won't you overthrow this government and stop the war? Why won't you do it? But it's still not quite, we will do it on our own. So that is the resolution of the July days. The workers learn that you can't make a revolution halfway and that you need the entire country to do it. The next phase of the struggle is this revolt. The left wing has revolted in St. Petersburg. Now the right wing revolts against the provisional government. A guy named Kornilov, who Kerensky had actually appointed head of the army, he's sort of a Pinochet-type character. He attempts to kind of in connivance with Kerensky, to organize military rule and have a coup d'etat and repress the workers' revolution. Kerensky freaks out. He turns to the Soviet for help. And now there's a question of, if we were holding the workers back a month ago, what do we say about Kerensky? Kerensky, who has been our enemy and has been in favor of the provisional government, we are for Soviet power, he is now saying, come help me, because if you don't help me, Kornilov is not only going to start by executing me and then he'll execute you. And so what do we do in the face of this right-wing assault? And here's the classic lesson in my mind of what we call the United Front, which is that in the face of right-wing danger or attacks, that you unify the left in order to defend the working class. But the United Front isn't just about unity. It's not just about we all come together against a common enemy. We do so from a revolutionary point of view in order to unite, in order to prove in practice that we are the ones who really want to fight all the way to the conclusion, that we are the ones that mean what we say and will do what we say. And if we can get the reformists, if we can get the liberals out there on our side temporarily, we will show in practice that we are better at fighting the right wing than they are, and we will win them away from we will win the working class and people away from the support for the liberals. Now, this is a very pointed situation. This isn't just like, you know, let's have a protest. This is essentially a fascist coup in the makings. And so this is a life and death struggle. But even in the life and death struggle, this is what Trotsky says about about how to relate to Kerensky. He says, this is the wonderful phrase that always sticks in my mind. He says, we will take our guns and we will use Kerensky as a gun rest on his shoulder to shoot at Kornilov. Now that is both support and unity, but it's a certain sort of unity, right? It's a little implied there that something might happen after you deal with Kornilov. And that is, in fact, exactly what happens. In that struggle, the Petrograd Soviet creates a thing called the Struggle Against Counter-Revolution, the Committee for the Struggle Against Counter-Revolution. And the Bolsheviks use this to rally the working class, to build unity amongst a big left faction of the Menshevik Party, which is coming over and getting sick of the right-wingers in the party, the Socialist Revolutionary Party. Chernov, the guy who they said, take power, you son of a bitch, Chernov is saying, we can't take power. Many of his rank and file are saying, this is absurd. We have to end the war tomorrow. We have to give the land to the peasants. peasantry. We're revolutionaries, after all. It's a huge split in the Social Revolutionary Party. The old conservatives are still in the government. The radicals are beginning to take over the whole party. So the Bolsheviks and the left form this thing called the Committee for Struggle Against Counter-Revolution, which pops up again in October. They defeat Kornilov, and there's enormous wave of sympathy for the Bolsheviks. The Bolsheviks win majority support in the Petrograd and the Soviet and the Moscow Soviet. They begin to pass resolutions in favor of Soviet power. If you ended the story there, it would be an incredible transformation. The Bolsheviks, from a tiny minority who had recently been repressed and exiled and sent underground, within 6 weeks' time, go to become the majority in the most important cities in the country. They begin to win huge sympathy within the army, within sections of the poor peasantry, although the left social revolutionaries were still far more important amongst the peasants and the soldiers. They become a mass force. The Bolshevik Party goes from being a party that was really hardcore, dedicated, underground organizers with an important following who had suffered terrible repression in those years after 1905. They become a mass movement. In January, there's 25,000 members. By October, there's 300,000 members. Hundreds of thousands of people are joining the Bolshevik Party. And they're not joining the Bolshevik Party on a clearly read understanding of everything that Lenin ever wrote. They are joining the Bolshevik Party because they say peace, land, and bread, overthrow the provisional government, down with the war, factories for the workers, land for the peasants, freedom for the oppressed nationalities. That's why I'm a Bolshevik. That's why hundreds of thousands of people join the Bolshevik Party. And if hundreds of thousands of people join your party, on the basis of all those slogans, you'd better deliver. Because if you do not deliver, they won't hang around for long, and they'll go looking for somebody who does what they say. And this is the problem now facing the Bolshevik Party. And this is the last phase of the question of power. In September and October, they realize, unbelievably, from being a hunted and oppressed minority, we are now the majority. We are winning huge support. But at the same time, the government has so destroyed the country, there is the danger of famine because the country is being torn apart by war. We are going to lose this war. In fact, the Germans had just taken the city of Riga in Latvia, which was only 100 miles from Petrograd. The bourgeoisie at this point starts to say, if we have to choose between Lenin and the Bolsheviks and the Kaiser and the German army occupying St. Petersburg, we take the Germans because the Germans will execute all of the revolutionaries, and eventually they'll hand power back to us. We would rather have German invasion than socialist revolution. So it is as knife edge as you can possibly get. And you would think in that moment that it would be an easy step to say, these are our sworn enemies who have killed us by the hundreds of thousands at the front and want to imprison us and will do so again. You would think it would be an easy step to say, they are the enemy, we should take power. But even at that level, taking power and creating a new form of organization that actually runs the country as opposed to negotiates with the old power is still a difficult psychological leap. Throughout September and October, the Bolsheviks and the left and other parties are debating, should we actually fight to take power? Should we overthrow the provisional government, or should we just keep hoping it collapses? And then eventually we'll kind of win by default. Or maybe they'll become so afraid of us that they'll negotiate with us. Or should we have an insurrection and overthrow the provisional government and actually take power in the name of the Soviets? This debate ripples through the Bolshevik Party. And I want to just give you a sense of this debate. And because it's not just this mass movement, it's not simply that there is a feeling, that there's a sentiment, that there's protests in the streets, there's strikes going on, there's revolt in the army, there's all that. But it still requires a political party to say, we will now organize the revolt and make it be power. And this is even in the heart of the Bolshevik Party. This becomes an incredible debate. We now need a plan to depose the provisional government and take power. Lenin then says in this debate, Zinoviev, his longtime friend, is now saying, down with the slogan, all power to the Soviets. And he insists that we simply continue to bring pressure on the provisional government. To say that an insurrection is ripe, says Lenin, means there's no talk of a conspiracy. If an insurrection is inevitable politically, it must be treated as an art, and the time has come. Zinoviev comes right back, and he says, there is no comparison with the February Revolution. If the Congress, that is the Congress of Soviets, puts pressure on the Constituent Assembly, called by the provisional government, this can't be compared with Menshevik policy. And he says, I have no problem if we propose an insurrection as a long-term prospect. That is, even in the Bolshevik Central Committee, at the moment of whether or not you take power, there is doubt. Lenin insists on a vote. They vote for the revolution. They carry out an insurrection in St. Petersburg and the Moscow. They relatively easily depose the Kerensky government because by that point it has very little support, but they nonetheless have to depose it. There's a very funny series of episodes with the guy who was in charge of giving the signal to the battleship that was going to fire a blank charge at the provisional government's last headquarters in the Winter Palace, that this was the last, basically, military surge to arrest the provisional government and hand power to the Soviets. And he says, and it's, I think it's a wonderful description, he kind of describes it as bumbling, but on the other hand, you get a sense of just how difficult it is to go from being the extreme opposition. These are people who look death in the face and organize revolts in the army. But when it came time to, we will now take power, this guy, this poor guy is stuck. He's in charge of putting up a red lantern to signal the battleship about when to shoot, and he finds that he can't find a red lantern. So he's running around saying, where the hell is the red? And he finally finds one, and then he realizes he can't get it lit. And he finally gets it lit, and then he has to hoist it up the flagpole, and he has this funny line where he says, I couldn't believe how hard it was to get a red lantern up a flagpole. And so time is passing. The provisional government, Kerensky actually escapes and goes off to organize a counter-revolutionary army in the meantime. But the attempt to actually go from being opposition, 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 to we are now in charge, I think the anecdote is really wonderful. So they defeat the forces in the provisional government, Kerensky flees, and the Soviet takes power. The provisional government has been arrested and deposed. We are on the precipice of saying we will now be the government and we will make our own laws and we will change the country radically. But even in the Soviet, a Menshevik officer gets up and he says, on behalf of the Mensheviki, he announced that the only possibility of a peaceful solution to the crisis was to begin negotiations with the provisional government, which was now arrested. Bring them out of jail and negotiate with them. He gets shouted down, and he says, because the Bolshevik have made a military conspiracy with the aid of the St. Petersburg Soviet without consulting the other factions and parties, we find it impossible to remain in the Congress and therefore withdraw. They walk out of the National Soviet Congress. People start screaming at him. But as this Menshevik is denouncing the insurrection, a young soldier comes forward, and this is how John Reed describes it. He says, scarcely had the Menshevik stepped down than a lean-faced soldier with flashing eyes leaped to the platform and dramatically lifted his hand. Comrades, he says, my family name is Peterson. I speak for the 2nd Lettish Rifles. We have heard the statements of two representatives of the army committees, that is the Menshevik. These statements would have some value if their authors had been representatives of the army. Wild applause. But they do not represent the soldiers. And then he argues, we've been trying to have an election for 2 months and the officers haven't permitted us. That is the old representative. I am the new representative. I am for overthrowing the provisional government and Soviet power. Wild applause. Bedlam. You know. And they eventually, Lenin steps to the fore and says, we will now, in the name of Soviet power, offer peace to the belligerent nations. And it is an important moment because it is finally the passage from extreme opposition to power. And with power, you can do things you can't do without power. You can say to the German high command, we will now begin negotiations to end the war, and we are in favor of an immediate armistice today and ending the war in the coming months, to all nations. We can say to the peasants who are already seizing the land, what you are doing was not legal under the old legal system. It is now the law of the land. Take the land, it is yours. To the workers in the factory, you no longer have to look at the boss as having police on their side. You now have the Red Guards on your side. You have power in the factories. For the oppressed nationality, for women, the right to vote, abortion, a decriminalization of homosexuality, we will make this law now. We will not beg the rulers to do it for us. And so this is the transformative step from working class revolt to working class revolution to workers in power. And I just want to end with a final statement because the drama all takes place in St. Petersburg, but it really shows why the Bolsheviks were right to not try to take power back in St. Petersburg in July. There's a guy named Albert Rice Williams who was a correspondent traveling around Russia, and he recorded a bunch of these incredible events. But this story, I think, is most poignant, and it helps you understand how deep the revolution went in all quarters, not just amongst the radical intelligentsia, not just amongst the best section of organized workers in the most advanced city, but throughout the whole country. So Albert Rice Williams is riding through this train through Siberia, and they come across a penal colony. And one of the things the Tsar did is, if you were an oppositionist or they just needed people, they would just grab you and stick you in Siberia and put you in a mine and work you until you died. So there's this place called Chirm, which I'm sure no one's ever heard of. Chirm, Siberia. Anybody? No, okay. So he says, this is what Albert Rice Williams, he says, as our train approached, this group of convicts came out of the mine, and we thought, are they going to kill us? Are they going to take our stuff? What's going to happen? And he says, as they got closer, we realized that they tell us they are the commissars of Chirm. At the same time, they signal the banner bearers, and the red standards rise before our eyes. On one in large letters is the old familiar slogan, proletarians arise, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Hats off, shouts the commissars. Awkwardly, they bare their heads and caps, and they begin to sing the International. I won't go through the whole thing, but arise, ye prisoners of starvation, arise, ye wretched of the earth. And then Albert Rice Williams says, I have heard the streets of cities around the world ringing to the International, ringing from the mass columns of the marchers. I have heard rebel students send it floating through college halls. I have heard the International and the voices of 2,000 Soviet delegates blending with military bands or rolling through the pillars of the Tauride Palace in St. Petersburg. But none of the singers looked the wretched of the earth. They were sympathizers or represented the wretched. These minor convicts, as in minors, not young people, these minor convicts of Chirm were the wretched themselves, most wretched of all, wretched in garments, looks, and even voice. And with broken voices, though they sang out of tune, you could feel the pain and the protest of all the broken through all of the ages. The sigh of the captive, the moan of the galley slave, the groan of the serf, stretched on the wheel, the cries from the cross, the anguish of myriads of the condemned welling up out of the past. And he says, more than that, they were not just protesting, they were not just citizens, but they were makers of a new society. Those red convicts of Chirm, those miners who were sentenced to die digging coal for the Tsar, coming out of their literally caves in their rags to present their political consciousness to a train of exiles passing through Siberia, shows the depth of the Russian Revolution, and it shows the future for the history. Shows the hope for the future. The last thing I'll say is this old phrase that Marx has about being determines consciousness. And one of the reasons it's important to take power and to make changes. In 1919, there was a revolution in Hungary, and this guy, Béla Kun, was the head of the Communist Party, and he was a terrible idiot ultra-left. And the situation in Hungary was so pointed that the workers took power, and a very small, inexperienced Communist Party took power in the name of the working class without much support. And Lenin got on the phone, and I think they call it the telegrammer or something like that, but got on the phone to Béla Kun and said, what is your new revolutionary government doing to immediately make changes in the lives of the ordinary people, especially in the lives of the peasantry? And Béla Kun said, we're not really worried about that. We've got mass support. We're going to delay the land reform. We're going to do it our way. We're not really going to listen to the peasants about what they want. And Lenin said, that's the worst mistake you can make. If you take power, you must immediately make improvements and dramatic changes in people's lives so that they understand that their participation, their power is real. If you come off as a fig leaf or as yet another imposter making promises like the provisional government has, they will turn against you or they will stand passively by while the imperialists come to slaughter you. And that's exactly what happened in Hungary. Being determines consciousness. It means that transgressing the line between resistance and power matters. Because as long as we are promising for the future that the teachers can run the schools, that the students can develop their own curriculum, that the nurses can run the hospitals, that workers' production can be done democratically so we can save the planet, as long as we are promising that for the future, we will be a movement in waiting. We will be a promise to the future. But until we are able to do it and show that it works, there will only ever be a minority of people who will really understand that you can do it. You need to prove in practice to the majority of people. And the only way to prove in practice to the majority of people that their lives will be dramatically different under socialism than under capitalism is to take power and to make those despotic encroachments into the rights of private property and to accumulation. And so I think Marx's dictum about being determines consciousness is not only about why people have bad ideas from the past, it's also a method for the future about not just taking power momentarily in a romantic, beautiful, symbolic way as they did in Paris, but in order to transform the world for future generations. And so I think that that is really the fundamental lesson that we have to learn from the Bolshevik Revolution. And I would encourage people to study it. The books are wonderful. Some of them are long, some of them are short. No one will teach you this. You have to go out and read the books yourselves. We need to figure out how to sustain some, in the 100th anniversary, but going forward, how to sustain discussion and knowledge, because it's such a complex phenomenon. You can't like read a pamphlet and be like, oh, I get it now. And that if you do, you probably misunderstood it. that it is really, when we walk through our lives as revolutionaries, it is not the blueprint for the future, but it is a template from the past against which we compare, against which we learn, against which we dialogue. And I think that if you have that in your bones, you will be a more effective revolutionary. And luckily, we have the resources now to help you do that.
That was Todd Kreshin on Red October, the Russian Revolution. He spoke at the International Socialist Organization's annual conference in Chicago. Todd Kreshin is a member of the International Socialist Organization and is the editor of Eyewitnesses to the Russian Revolution. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Richard Wolff, Cynthia Kaufman, David Harvey, Angela Davis, Noam Chomsky, Stephen Cohen, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Todd Kreshin on Red October, the Russian Revolution, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.